Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley has some advice on whether Super Bowl week is a good time to buy a new TV. Plus some tax quirks you should be on the lookout for and some information on a new report on the financial meltdown. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, February the 1st. And as always, there's plenty of room for your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Joining me now from our studios in Eau Claire, Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
I understand you were cutting it a little bit close this morning. Are the roads a little dicey in Eau Claire?
Yeah, and again, I summoned the Wisconsin Public Radio helicopter to come and land on my roof and pick me up and ferry me over to the studio. And once again, I was disappointed, so I was forced to drive over here, and I would like you to see to that, please.
Well, my limo got stuck this morning, so I don't know if I'm going to help or not. Sure. Anyway, well, I'm glad you made it, and good to have you here. We should talk about this this recent postmortem on the financial crisis. So what's the verdict?
Well, the verdict from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is something that just about anyone who had been paying any attention at all could have written. This was a 10-member committee which was appointed, various people, backgrounds, bureaucrats, served in the Treasury and different White House administrations over the last few decades. This actually had some precedent. After 1929 and the stock market crash, a commission was formed called the Pecora Commission. This particular one, the FCIC, the new one, did 700 interviews, 19 days of testimony, published 545 pages that basically tried to answer the question, why did this happen?
Yeah, so why did this happen?
Well, they found it was avoidable. First of all, in terms of calling individuals out, Alan Greenspan received quite a bit of a blame for this and when he was running the Federal Reserve by cutting interest rates down to basically nothing. He encouraged speculation, encouraged lower mortgage rates, which certainly helped the housing crisis or housing boom and then crisis come along. Bankers were putting profits above everything else. Regulators were letting the banks go too far and not hold enough capital. Lenders weren't exercising prudence when they were lending money to homeowners. Borrowers were borrowing too much. Some were falsifying documents, and some of that was done with the encouragement of the lenders. The rating agencies like Moody's and Standard & Poor's gave AAA ratings to securities that should have been rated basically as junk paper. Politicians of both parties were guilty of serving their constituents' interest in the short term and not worrying about long-term problems. There were some nice juicy details in this report, and in 545 pages, you'd hope something interesting would come up. Lots of stories of internal emails being bandied about on Wall Street at these banking firms where these people were just doing everything they could to not only protect their companies, but perhaps more importantly to them, trying to protect their million-dollar bonuses, begging each other to be bailed out, begging politicians to be bailed out. So it was nice to see them humbled and crawling on their knees for a little while.
Imagine that. Do you overall agree with the conclusions?
Well, yes, but it's kind of like saying, you know, there's a when a car crash happens, it's because we were all driving too fast. Mm-hmm. And they stated what happened, but there wasn't much in there to prevent it from occurring again. After that commission in 1929, after the stock market crash back then, was formed a little over a year later, there were rules and legislation and laws in place to prevent it from happening again. And to a great degree, several decades went by before there was anything close to that type of crisis.
And you don't think much change has come that will stop another problem in the future?
Well, first of all, if it does, it's not going to come out of this report, because only six members of the 10-member commission even endorsed the report. Excuse me. It was really along party lines. There were six Democrats and four Republicans. And many members of both parties are still taking action that are trying to extend and pretend what we're doing right now. There's a rule in place that basically allows banks to not have to value securities and mortgages on their books at the current market value, because if they did, they would be undercapitalized and they would basically have to go out of business. There are going to be more bailouts. There's been no accountability for anyone's actions that triggered the crisis, no criminal prosecutions or civil prosecutions. Borrowers and lenders are being hurt by this, especially Main Street borrowers and lenders. And the Wall Street influence is more pervasive and prevalent than ever. And it, again, is with both parties. Until there is some political push where people say, look, we are willing to suffer some short-term pain so that this doesn't happen again, we're not going to see many or any changes. And it makes it more likely that another crisis is going to occur. And even the phrase from the old Pogo comic strip was quoted in the report, "The enemy is us."
What sort of short-term pain are we going to have to endure in order to stop a similar crisis from happening again?
Well, we have to slow down. We have to accept the fact that the problems that the American and global economy are facing are structural and aren't solved with easy fixes and not extend and pretend. We should take our pain and our medicine right now. It's probably politically unpopular. It's going to hurt while it happens. But again, it's a short-term pain so that we don't have a bigger long-term problem down the road.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your own financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you if you have a money matter on your mind. You can also send us an email, onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And in our On Your Money email box segment, Zoe in Illinois has inherited an IRA from a parent. And Kevin, she wants to know if she can convert this IRA to a Roth IRA.
Well, technically, no, Zoe cannot. Only a spouse can convert an inherited IRA to a Roth, meaning that the spouse has to inherit that IRA from the deceased spouse. And there are withdrawal requirements that Zoe has to do where she has to draw money out of that IRA and pay taxes on it, but it's according to her life expectancy under most circumstances. However, she can use that money to kind of channel it into a Roth IRA through kind of a backdoor strategy, if you will.
How would that work?
Okay, well, assuming she's eligible to contribute to a Roth IRA and there are limits to the earnings, you have to have earned income. Either you or your spouse has to have enough earned income, but not too much. Generally, it's about $100,000 of adjusted gross income for single people, or about $160,000 for married couples filing jointly. She can take part of that IRA out and use that money, pay taxes on it, to channeled into a Roth IRA as long as she is eligible to make it. She can put up to $5,000 or her earnings, whichever are less, or $6,000 if she's over 50. So she can take, let's say, $6,000 out of the IRA, the inherited IRA, if she is over 50, and then pay taxes on it and then move it into the new Roth IRA, but as a contribution instead until the balance of the inherited IRA is completed.
So that's the backdoor strategy. Is there a standard way to convert an inherited IRA to a Roth?
Yeah, it can, and it maybe should be done, but only if the parent, the original owner of an IRA in which they intend to leave to a child, an adult child, or even a minor child, is still alive. It really should be predicated on who is going to be in the highest bracket. If let's say I'm a fairly wealthy retiree and I have a large IRA. I probably don't want to convert it to a Roth IRA while I'm alive. I'd rather leave it to my children or my grandchildren and let them convert it or pull the money out at their much lower tax bracket. On the other hand, if I'm in a fairly low tax bracket and my children or grandchildren are going to be in a higher tax bracket when they pull the money out of the IRA, when they inherit whatever's left, then I probably do want to convert some of it and pay taxes on it now to a Roth IRA. Basically, the rule of thumb is line 43 on your 1040. If that's over $34,000 for single filers and $68,000 for married couples filing jointly, then you're going to be in the 25% tax bracket. So if you can convert some of the IRA and still stay in the 15% tax bracket below those figures, then it's probably a good idea to do it.
I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
If you need some help with personal financial matters, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A reminder that tonight at 7 o'clock, Wisconsin Public Radio brings you live coverage of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's State of the State address, followed by a response from Democratic State Senator Peter Barca. It's the State of the State tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will also follow up on the State of the State all morning long tomorrow morning with a wide variety of guests from many different perspectives talking about the future of the state of Wisconsin. To the phones now for Kevin McKinley, and our first caller is Rick in Sheboygan. Hello, Rick.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've got a question about municipal bonds and their risk of default, and I'm not actually asking about specific ones, but generally, what's the concept of municipal bonds being in jeopardy of being defaulted upon?
Well, it's gotten a lot of attention in the news lately, and even on this show a few weeks ago. Municipal bonds are issued by state and local governments, and they're generally for projects like, let's say they want to build a swimming pool. Well, they issue bonds for $3 million, and then they hope that the tax revenue that comes back into the municipality can not only pay the municipal bond owners the interest, but then also pay the bonds off at maturity. And in return for accepting a lower interest rate, the bondholders generally do not have to pay federal taxes on the interest. So for people in a higher tax bracket, municipal bonds can be a very attractive source of relatively safe income. The problem, of course, as you and most people recognize, is that if there isn't enough revenue coming into the municipality to cover not only the expenses of running a particular project, plus, you know, paying employees, et cetera, that they have to either raise taxes, which is a politically untenable thing to do, or they have to default on the bond, meaning that they tell people, look, you're not going to get your money back, or you're not going to get as much back as what you thought. And with the slowing economy and slower tax revenues coming in for various reasons, it's made it more likely that some municipal bonds will default. That doesn't mean you should avoid them. It just means that you should know that if you put money into a municipal bond, it's perhaps more riskier now than what it might have been when times were very good. Again, that doesn't make it bad. It just means that you shouldn't bet on the money always being there. And you should really only consider it as part of a mutual fund generally. And also, if you are indeed going to be in a very high tax bracket, otherwise you're probably better off going with government bonds or FDIC-insured certificates of deposit if you are looking for safety.
Thanks very much, Rick. Our next caller is Gerald in Kenosha. Hi, Gerald.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 78-year-old filing joint, and our adjusted gross income is $25,000. I earn $2,400 profit from a small business. May I contribute $2,000 to a Roth IRA?
Hold on, Gerald. I think Kevin is mulling.
I'm pondering. I'm trying to think what would be, let me ask you this. What would be the purpose of making that contribution, Gerald?
Oh, because I really don't need the money, and I would like to open a Roth IRA with it.
Okay, so the advantage would be, of course, that you're going to, you're not going to get a tax break on it generally, but you're going to defer any taxes on the interest until you pull it out, right?
Right, but I'm working Form 8880, and it seems like it would lower my taxes.
Right, not in terms of actually getting a tax deduction on the Roth IRA, but because are you talking about taking the savers credit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to cover that in a few weeks, and it's a good idea for many people out there who don't think, well, geez, I don't make that much money. What benefit could I get from either using a regular IRA, Roth IRA, and the savers credit is actually a pretty neat little credit. It gives you an instant return on your deposit. It's not huge, but it's something to consider, and it's immediate in the form of lower taxes. The risk is relatively small for it. Yeah, do you see a reason why you couldn't do it?
No, I worked Form 8880, and it seems like I can use it. I've read it and went to the library and read it again, and I do qualify as far as I can see.
Yeah, and the neat thing about it with Roth IRAs is that if you decide that you do not or you shouldn't have done this, and this is true for anyone of any age and income, or you can't do it, you can always back the contributions back out of a Roth IRA and do whatever you want with the money. So for people who are eligible and are considering, yes, I would definitely encourage you and others to go ahead and do it.
Yes, and that's called the Retirement Savings Contribution, that 8880 form.
That's right.
Well, I thank you very much. I'll be listening in a couple of weeks when you have it on there again.
Gerald, will you do my taxes, Gerald?
Yes, that's one thing I'm good at, yes. And I thank you very much. I thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you, Gerald, very much for the call. He's a sharp cookie. Found that particular item. I know I wouldn't have.
Anything I can do to help a 78-year-old hopefully retire someday, I'm glad to do that.
Yes.
Gerald sounds like a very nice man. He deserves some time off.
Yes. Shane in Hales Corners is with us now. Hi, Shane.
Hi there. I'm 62 years old, and I'm just going to be getting my Social Security, and it'll be around $1,600 a month. And because I'm not employed, I'll need about 600 of that. But the other 1,000, I'm wondering what I should do with it.
Besides giving it to public radio, Kevin.
Yes, I already do.
Okay.
Jane, you wouldn't believe the size of the tote bag you'll get for $1,000 a month contribution to public radio. It's gigantic. So you're saying this is going to be extra money. Do you have any high interest debt outstanding?
I got a little bit of a MasterCard that I thought I would pay off probably with the first month of the Social Security.
Okay. Good.
And then after that, I'm pretty well clear.
Okay. Do you have roughly 12 months of liquid savings at your disposal?
I have a 401k with quite a bit in there.
Okay.
That I could get out. I don't have a lot of savings, but I have the 401k.
Okay. Well, good. You answered your own question then. Good for you. And it makes me even more irrelevant. The fact that you have a nice 401k is great, but if you need a larger lump sum of money and you don't have any savings set aside, you're going to get hit very hard when you try to access the money in that 401k because you're going to have to pay taxes on it. And because we are in a progressive tax bracket country, the more money you take out of that 401k in a given calendar year, the higher the tax rate is going to be on the withdrawal. So I would just want to have you put that $1,000 aside in a normal, boring
checking account, money market, something insured, FDIC insured at a bank or credit union if you can find one. Don't worry about the interest rate and saying I'm trying to make 2 or 3% on it. You're more concerned about being able to get at that money in an emergency with no cost, no penalty, and no worry of loss, and most importantly, no taxes. So just build up a savings account in there until you have about 12 months of monthly expenses set aside there. Then you might want to look at, you know, some other mutual funds or other options out there.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the call. Good luck to you, Shane. And now we go to Neil in Cameron. Hello, Neil.
Hi. Say, our first daughter attended University of Wisconsin Oshkosh this past fall semester, and we had to take out loans, and she got a loan through the FAFSA program. And the first, my portion, the parents' portion, is about $5,500. And I believe her portion was similar, about about $2,500 for that semester. So about $7,500 total for that semester. And this is my first time doing taxes with a child in college. So I was thinking about this yesterday, how I was going to approach this, and then lo and behold, I get a 1098-T form in the mail yesterday. However, the 1098-T form doesn't match the money that I thought that we had paid to college, and it was only $3,800, and it was in her name. So I'm a little confused, somewhat scratching my head on how to approach this. I was expecting to be able to use the full $7,500 from both of us, or at least my $5,500 from myself as a tax, a type of tax write-off, I guess.
So no one sends me 1098-T forms in the mail. Kevin, what is that?
Well, my grandma said that if you don't send out 1098-Ts to anyone, you're not going to get any 1098-Ts.
Okay.
So it's a reciprocity issue. Mm-hmm. That's what they talk about when they're talking about college tuition. You hear about it? It's reciprocity. Actually, Neil has made a problem go viral here because I'm just as confused about this as he is now. So, Neil, I'm very sorry. I can't help you with this. You are concerned about the amounts not matching up and what issues you can take with credit, the dollar amounts that you can use, and what was actually paid versus what's being reported, correct?
Correct. That is correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you verify the amounts with the good people at UW Oshkosh and the bursar's office?
I have not yet. I just got the form yesterday, late afternoon in the mail, and I had not had a time to approach that yet. But, yeah, like I said, you know, it was about $5,500 for my portion, which I certainly expected to take, and it was more for our daughter, you know, an additional $2,500 or so for our daughter's portion. Mm-hmm. And I get this form for $3,800, and I just really scratch my head. I'm like, well, that doesn't really match anything that I come up with. So,
with all the money that you and your family are spending at UW Oshkosh, that you could call the bursar day or night. There should be a cell phone number. You should just dial. Hi, it's me, Neil, again, the one who you're taking $15,000 to $20,000 a year from for questionable value of an education.
Our daughter did come back home. I'll have to say our daughter did come back home, and she is now going to a local 2-year campus at 7 miles away from our house to save some of that money. So we did make a little bit of a change there.
Okay. That's actually a smart move, and it's nothing against UW Oshkosh. It's a fine school, but that a lot of people who don't think about this too deeply tend to realize too late that the cost of going to school, only half of it is tuition. The other half is room and board. Mm-hmm. And if you can have a kid live at home free to a great extent, that saves quite a bit of money of going to school. So good for you. Stop paying UW Oshkosh if you don't have a daughter enrolled there. But I would call them and just say, what's the deal with this? I got this form. I want to make sure the numbers match up. Start there and then go to call the IRS and do that. It's a good thing you're doing it now because they're swamped at irs.gov on the website and the phone number. But call them and see what they say about matching those numbers up.
Neil, good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We will take more of your calls in just a moment. We will also find out from Kevin if Super Bowl week is a good time or not to buy a new TV. That's coming up a little bit later as On Your Money continues. Time now for Smart Assets. And we have mentioned some quirks that taxpayers will face in the next few weeks as they try to prepare and file their 2010-1040s. Today, Kevin will dive deeper into some of the changes that might affect you. So, Kevin?
Well, we'll start with the basics. And just because you do not receive a 1040 in the mail from the IRS, that does not mean you're absolved from filing and paying your income taxes. There aren't going to be any forms mailed this year. The IRS and the state tax revenue departments are encouraging e-filing, which about two-thirds of people do right now anyway. Along with that e-filing, though, they're also requiring an e-signature. So you should get started on that because you will have to put a digital signature into their tax form. The good news is you have a couple more days to file your federal taxes this year because of a holiday. April 18th is the due date, not April 15th for mm-hmm. your federal taxes, but you still have to file by the 15th for your state taxes. So you have a very narrow window there, especially because many people, even those who are prepared, have all their information at hand and want to get going, a lot of them can't actually file their taxes yet.
Yeah, in fact, I seem to remember that you told me that I might not be able to file until mid-February sometime. What's up?
Well, there's a couple categories of people who will be affected. First of all, anyone who is expecting to receive a 1099 for dividend payments or interest payments that they received, those might be delayed or might even be corrected later down the road. So even the ones you receive might not be the actual ones you should use to file. More importantly and more broadly, anyone who itemizes is probably going to have to wait to file until February 15th. The reason being is there were a lot of tax changes right at the end of the year. On December, I think 18th was the day they finalized some of the laws. And so the IRS computers weren't up to speed fast enough to get all of the changes and things that remain the same into the system. You still want to get started now, though. And in fact, even if many of our listeners use TurboTax or some kind of electronic program to file, TurboTax actually has a system in place where you can file, get everything in, and if you're an itemizer, it'll put it in queue so you can make a change. But if you don't make any changes, it'll automatically submit it once itemizers can put it in. The bad news, again, of course, about delaying filing your taxes is you're probably going to have to delay getting your refund and spending it.
But still, electronic filers usually do get your refund if you're getting one back pretty soon, don't you?
Fairly quickly, that's right. Excuse me. And that's one of the things one of the things that people do have to watch out for right now is getting that loan, getting that refund back and not using the loan system. But we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah. So do you have any advice on low cost options for help in preparing tax returns?
Yeah, there actually is good news on that front. If you're making under $58,000 of adjusted gross income, you qualify for the free file program, and you can find out more about it at irs.gov. And then H&R Block actually has gone one step further than that, where if you use the 1040EZ program and you use H&R Block system before February 14th, this is the simpler program for people who generally don't have a lot of documents to go with it and don't have to itemize, they'll do the whole thing for free for you. Now, the reason they're doing that is they want to, upsell you to refund anticipation loans. They want to, have you pay them to file a state return, et cetera. So if you do use that, watch out for other fees that you might incur. But the H&R Block with the 1040EZ does have a free filing option before February 14th.
Okay. What about those of us who use a paid professional? Will we be affected in any way?
Not so much the taxpayer, but the preparer has some increased scrutiny from the government, more so to make sure that they're qualified, that they're submitting the information that they should and appropriately so.
it's kind of moving. There's a bifurcation, if you will, between do-it-yourselfers with TurboTax and those programs, and then people who really need a good, solid CPA. There are going to be less people in the middle and less options for that. But if you are using an individual, you do want to schedule the appointment right now because those people are going to be very, very busy. And it really is, let's see, February, March, April, it's 2.5 months. It's about 10 weeks until your taxes will be due.
Kevin McKinley, a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He's with us just about every Tuesday for On Your Money. And we have time for you if you have a question for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Trent in Albany is with us. Hello, Trent.
Hi, good morning. My question is in regards to precious metals, gold or silver. I've never been a big fan of them in the past, but with mounting debt and the chance of the dollar in the future years losing reserve currency status, I wanted to get your opinion.
And about whether or not,
yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
About whether or not you should use precious metals?
Yeah, gold, silver, what your thoughts were.
Wait a minute, Trent. I just have to ask, what is that sound in the background?
Heavy equipment.
Oh, okay. Sounded like, I don't know what, but anyway, heavy equipment. All right. Kevin, so precious metals, a good investment at the moment?
It depends on your perspective. Precious metals can be a nice little hedge against a falling dollar, meaning that hopefully the precious metal retains its value while the dollar is falling. In the last few weeks or so, that hasn't been the case. There's been a huge speculative bid up in not just in gold, which has gone from $250 to $300 an ounce all the way up to almost $1,500 an ounce and over in the last couple of years. Silver has also had a similar rise, and that's generally been from a couple of reasons. One has been demand worldwide, but the other one has been falling currencies. Many governments are racing toward the bottom with their currency valuation. The problem with precious metals is several fold. One is which they're very illiquid. So if you invest in there and you need to get your money out, no matter what form you use, the more closer you are to the metal, if you will, the more difficult it is to get the money back out. If you're walking around with Krugerrands in your pocket, you got to either spend them or sell them to actually use them for something. And the further away you are from the metal, the more likely it is that there's some cost or friction between you actually owning the metal and the amount of value you're going to net out of it. So it's a nice investment for a small portion of it, but in terms of a big part of the portfolio, it's very difficult for most people to put a huge portion of their assets into any kind of precious metal.
Trent, thanks a lot for the call and good luck to you. We'll find out if buying a new TV during Super Bowl week is a good investment in just a moment. And then more of your phone calls for Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me you better shop around.
Well, I know I'll be watching part of the Super Bowl on Sunday on my fat TV as opposed to a flat screen TV. And Kevin, I was wondering if I should consider shopping around for a new TV during Super Bowl week. What do you think?
There's a Super Bowl this week?
Well, yes, there is on Sunday.
Really? Who's playing?
The Packers, Kevin. Yeah,
the
I know.
Packers
I know.
Are good. The Gold Green Bay Packing Company. Yeah, if you're going to look for a new TV, Joy, and by the way, you do know that you have to be careful about mentioning objects that you don't have because sometimes they just show up on your doorstep.
Oh, gosh, that's right. I do not want a listener to offer to send me a flat screen TV. Or do
Maybe
I?
Maybe they can have you over for a party or something.
Right.
It's actually a very good time of year to be looking for a TV anyway, but especially in Wisconsin, you know, if you picked up a flyer or you've turned on your old TV, you've seen tons of ads for these right now. Now, usually you can go online to get better deals. Amazon.com has some of the best TV prices out there. There are a couple problems with that. First of all, you don't get to look at the TV. Second of all, if you want it quickly, even with the shipping, free shipping or next day shipping, it's going to be very difficult to get it to your house in time for the game. So you definitely want to go to a local place, go in store. You can see the TV there. You can ask more questions for it and compare them, and then you can bring it home. But there are some things that you need to know before you do that.
Yeah. What's the first thing I need to know?
Well, much like mattresses last week, which we discussed, paying a lot more money does not necessarily equal higher satisfaction on behalf of the buyer, especially if this is a replacement for your old fat set. You will be so impressed by just the screen picture and quality alone. You definitely want to invest in more money in screen size and less in the gadgets and the add-ons with it, especially if you find one that has a higher resolution. But you can still get a very good basic set at many different outlets for under $500. However, that might not be the biggest portion of your expenditure.
What would that biggest portion be?
Well, if you want to make the most of the TV or even just use it, you first of all might have to have digital channels on your on your cable or your satellite provider. I would recommend this. It's one of those things that you made it through several decades of life without high definition channels, but now once you have it, it's kind of hard to go back again. So contact your cable dish provider, find out what packages that they might have if you do need to upgrade the channels to take advantage of your new TV. Also, big screens do not mean big sound. Generally, television manufacturers do not invest a whole lot of money into the speakers. And so while you might be wowed by the view that you get on the TV, you'll be disappointed with the tinny sound coming through the speakers. So if you can't attach it to your stereo and get the sound through there, you might want to also look at one of those surround sound systems. But you can get a decent one for anywhere from $100 to $200.
So once you've found your TV, anything else you should know?
Yeah, find out the details. Most stores have a return policy. So if you get it home, you just don't like the way it looks for whatever reason, you can return it, but there may be a restocking fee, and that's usually a fairly short one, and I'm guessing they're going to enforce that fairly strictly if they get a rush of TVs back on Monday morning, and especially if the Packers, God forbid, do lose and there's a, you know, a brandy bottle size smash in the middle of the television or so. They probably won't take that back. When you are installing your new TV, try to install it next to the old one, because what a nightmare it would be to spend all this money, get excited, you rip out your old television, throw it away, get the new one all set up, and you can't get it to work. So not only are you can't even watch the game on your old TV, much less the new one. So try to install them side by side. If you are pulling plugs out of your old TV to put into the new one, mark them down, because the more holes in the back of the set, if you will, the more difficult it is going to be to find out where they were supposed to go if you do need to reattach it. And finally, if you set this TV up, you turn it on, and something doesn't seem right, write it down and call the seller as soon as you find that out.
Well, besides watching the Super Bowl on a brand new TV, is there, you know, any other advantages for my new TV set after that?
Absolutely. You want to hook it up to the internet if you possibly can, if you have access to a high-speed internet connection and you can hook it up to the television. You should try to do so, not only for web surfing on a bigger screen, but also looking at videos on YouTube or Hulu or Vimeo, and most importantly and most cost-effective, trying to get a Netflix subscription for about $8 to $10 could save you a lot of money on what you would otherwise be paying on cable. The other thing I would definitely recommend you consider while you're looking at upgrading your cable or your satellite package to take advantage of your new TV's features is get a DVR. It is so nice to have, you know, press two buttons and it's generally on the DVR, digitally stored for as long as you have room for it. And even, you know, if you can't watch the game or whatever, you can record the Super Bowl on the DVR, but then until you get to watch it, you get the thrill of, you know, walking around the rest of the week. Don't tell me how it ended. I haven't seen it yet.
We'll never find out. Yeah. You know, Kevin, I'm going to put that on the list. We've just been, it hasn't been a priority, a new TV, but you convinced me last week that we need to invest in that new mattress first. I realized that we are still on the same mattress that we had 25 years ago when we got married. Do you believe it?
Yes, actually, I do believe that. I think it's so, the change and the degradation, not of your marriage, but of your mattress, is so slow that you just don't realize it. And then it's not until you actually sleep on a new mattress, like when you check into a hotel or someplace, you go, what is wrong with this bed? What is this, you know? I feel firmness where my hips normally bottom out near to the box spring. So,
right.
Yeah, I'd recommend you do it. Keep the old one around. Maybe you like that one better, but I'd definitely check it out.
Pretty sure that our TV is about that old too. So time to replace some of those items. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley. He is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And time now for some more of your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And Jerry in Oshkosh is with us. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Hi, Kevin. I got a question for my father. He's getting married. He's 73. And his fiance also is 73. They're both widows. The question is on Social Security as far as benefits. Will she lose her Social Security or have to go on his, or they both keep what they currently have?
Is she getting a benefit based on, first of all, congratulations, mazel tov to both of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people getting married, coupling up like this, that generally makes me happy. I'm always optimistic about it. A widow and a widower getting together and getting married at the age of 73, I couldn't be happier for them. So I'm glad you're asking about it, and I hope that you support them too, because that's they're going to be much happier, hopefully. So good for them. She will lose benefits that she has been receiving from her late husband, if you will, but she will, or I shouldn't say she will, she may lose benefits that she's been receiving on her late husband. She still qualifies, of course, for any benefits she would have been receiving on her own. And then, of course, they'll each qualify for each other's benefits going forward because they are now officially married. So there is a window where I can't remember how long it is, but they actually will now qualify for each other's benefits now that they are officially married. So yes, if she were collecting something on her late husband, she will lose that now that she's officially married. It's one of the downsides to getting married later in life, but hopefully not enough reason to get married or not get married.
Yeah, very romantic. Congratulations to your father and his new bride, Jerry. Anything else?
No, that was it. Thank you.
Hey, thanks very much.
Hey, Jerry, would you do me one thing?
Yeah.
The night before they get married, would you sit your dad down and have a talk with him about his wedding night?
Will do. Thank you.
That is good. All right, Jerry, thanks very much. Marjorie in Heartland is with us now. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, it's Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call this morning. I have a question. I'm a 38-year-old stay-at-home mom, and I do occasional freelancing. I'm looking into taking some continuing education courses, and I currently contribute my max to the to the Roth IRA, and my husband is a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army, so he has a real good retirement package, and also has a good retirement package at his current job. So my question for you, Kevin, is, Is it a smart idea to take out the Roth IRA to pay for a continuing education certificate?
As a last resort?
As a last resort. Okay.
Yeah. Do you have other options, either in cash or debt, that you can get at?
What I could do is the contribution that I'm making monthly, I could use that to pay for the certificate.
Okay.
And then I also make just a little money of teaching some exercise courses, but that's not big money.
Okay. I mean, if you have, there are probably three tiers, I guess, I would use to pay for that. The first one is regular cash that you have in savings. The second one is the Roth IRA contributions, which you can withdraw at any time for any purpose whatsoever and pay no taxes or penalties. How much is the total certificate going to cost for you, Marjorie?
Probably 2,000. It's not big money, but I just don't have a lot of liquid cash in my savings right now.
Yep.
So that's the only reason I was considering it.
Yeah, if you're thinking about that, I'm a big fan of keeping liquidity and paying interest, meaning that it's usually better for many people to have some debt and some savings rather than no debt but no savings, because if you run into an emergency, it's difficult to borrow money at that time. Now, with your husband's income and pension and your income, it sounds like that making the payments on borrowing that $2,000 isn't going to be a big issue. So if you can borrow money either against home equity or there's a low-interest student loan you can get, I would suggest you get that rather than tapping your savings if you are concerned about chewing through that fairly quickly.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted your opinion on it. I really appreciate your opinion. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call. And Bill in Appleton is with us next. Hello, Bill.
Good morning. Kevin, I have a beneficiary IRA that I've been, over the last 3 years, drawing down enough from that account for a contribution for myself and my wife for our individual IRAs. Mm. So I'm glad to hear you're following my practice. And the problem I'm having now is that I'm at the point where I have roughly one more withdrawal to do for tax year 2010, but I can't liquidate the account because there's 9 Ginnie Mae bond funds left in the account, and their market value is maybe $300 or $400, and they're unmarketable, and I've been told I can't transfer the bonds out of an account, say to a charitable organization, and I can't sell them. So do you have any idea? They're almost fully paid down. There's maybe, $200 or $300 to pay down for them to be fully, for the principal to be fully paid down. So I'm kind of stuck.
And they're bond funds or actual bonds?
They're bonds. They are Ginnie Mae bonds.
Ginnie Mae bonds. You can't sell them. There's no price that you can't get a bid for them, is what they're telling you, right?
If I had 25,000 of them, then I could get a bid. But I have 9 of them.
Mm-hmm. How soon is that going to get out there? I mean, is it a case where they're going to return the principal quickly over the next 12 months or so?
No, it's probably 2 years, maybe 3 years. So I have two problems. One is it costs $50 a year to keep the account open.
Right.
And the other problem is it's a 50% penalty if I don't take it out by the time the 5-year term is up.
There is an excise tax in there for money that's supposed to be taken out of an IRA, either for a living owner who's over 70 and a half or for an inheritor who doesn't take it out. I would check to see if there's another place to sell. Everything is sellable for a price, and especially in this case, for better or for worse, either you're going to find someone who will give you some bid for it or, geez, good news. Between the fees and the excise tax, the money will all be gone quickly and you won't have to worry about it anymore. But I understand why you'd want to get that out sooner. And you've checked with I assume this is held at a brokerage account?
It is. It's held at a brokerage account, and they will not handle the transaction, like I said, unless there's 25,000 of them. They won't even touch the transaction.
I would call some of the discount brokers around, the larger ones like Fidelity, Charles Schwab, TD Ameritrade is another big one, and see if they will take in and then sell the securities and see if you can get that. I actually get your problem, and I'm surprised it hasn't come up before, but I'm not sure that there's a solution to it other than trying to find somebody to get rid of the thing.
Yeah, we'll have to report back on this one, Kevin, as we're out of time. Just time enough for the website of the week.
Well, lifehacker.com is a phenomenal site for a lot of reasons, but one of the things they've done is they put together a really nice printout of the best time to buy anything during the calendar year, which is whether it's TVs, snowblowers, lawnmowers. Lifehacker.com will put a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com. later on today.
And 4 more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Thank you, Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin will be back with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Chris Molina for producing the program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.